Blog Talk Radio.
Today on Backroom Politics, the commander in appeasement. Obama addresses the General Assembly of the UN, many calling it an appeasement, many calling it savvy foreign policy. We'll discuss the latest on that subject. Mitt Romney seems to be having a good week, but it's only Tuesday. Give him a second. Great performance at the Global Leadership, at the Clinton Global Initiative, and on Education Nation on MSNBC. But, again, week's still early. Civility in politics. Why is civility not working? The Brown Warren War up in Massachusetts has taken a nasty turn after they promised to be civil. We're going to investigate why civility just doesn't work in today's politics. That and tell me a story today on Backroom Politics. In the nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio from Chili's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital. Joining me as they do every Tuesday, he is the former 8-term member of Congress representing Washington's 2nd Congressional District, former Vice President of Government Affairs for Burlington Northern Railroad. He is the Honorable Congressman Al Swift. Hi, Al.
How are you, my friend?
Doing fantastic. Sitting to my 11 o'clock, as he does every Tuesday, he is the former Undersecretary of Commerce. He has worked for, at last count, 4 presidents. He is a longtime Senate staffer, a longtime Washington insider, and a very distinct, a very distinguished and charming fellow for the Stimson Center. He is the Honorable Alan Moore. Hello, Alan.
Justin, nice to be here.
Good to see you, sir. To my across-the-table 12 o'clock position, he is the former floor chief for then-Congressman Gerald Ford, longtime Washington insider, former Vice President of Government Affairs for the National Broadcasting Corporation. He is Bob Hines. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Justin. Glad to be here.
And to my right, he is the Vice President for China Studies at the Eurasia Center. He is a bar-certified attorney in the great state of New York and the District of Columbia. He is Dr. Ralph Whitty. Hi, Ralph.
Hi, Justin. Glad to be with everyone.
Good.
Today.
And I'm your moderator, Radio's Justin Russell, and we've got a lot to talk about today. We're going to start off today talking a little bit about the UN General Assembly, particularly the president giving his address to the General Assembly as they convene in New York City. Thus, for those of you listening in Manhattan, there's traffic snafus for the next week. But a lot of different opinions coming in about the president's speech today. Now, Alan Moore, you said you read the speech. I actually heard it live today, but you actually said you heard the speech today. What was your initial impression of the speech?
I didn't see huge glaring problems with it. He gave a little bit of a America free speech 101 kind of a statement. He talked about the need for people to be careful of their words, but also the importance that we in America and many free countries place on the ability to say whatever you want, even if it is hurtful and not a good idea. He talked about Iran. He put a little, there's this question about exactly what the line in the sand over Iran is, and he basically said, we will not allow Iran to get a nuclear weapon. Having said that, he didn't say anything further about measuring sticks, actions, talked about the community of nations that's working together to stop it. It was, in my mind, safe, pedestrian. I didn't see it as appeasement.
Bob Hines, did you happen to listen to it, or have you gotten any word back on it? Or
I've heard reports about it, and it sounded to me, I mean, pretty much like what Alan said. I mean, I thought it was, I wouldn't call it boilerplate, but it was a kind of a speech that an American president tends to make when he goes to an international meeting like that.
Al, Congressman Al, what did you think? Were you able to catch the speech today?
I did not catch it. I did not hear it or read it. However, there are two views on foreign policy, roughly, in our country. And one is, speak softly and carry a big stick, and some are yell and shout and maybe carry a big stick. And some people think that if you don't, in the circumstances the president was in, if you don't lambaste the hell out of somebody, you're not being tough enough, and that translates quickly into appeasement. And I think that's just a thing that happens depending on your outlook on foreign policy.
Ralph, were you able to catch the speech today?
Just a little bit of it. I think it would have been important for Obama to really come out tough against Ahmadinejad and his unwillingness to curb the weapons program in Iran. Many countries are very concerned that Iran is very close to developing nuclear weapons that would be very dangerous to the rest of the world. And I think the U.S. has to lead, and they should go after Ahmadinejad in a very tough way. Especially since the opportunity is growing dim in terms of being able to stop them from developing that technology.
Oh, could I ask?
Yeah, go ahead. Congressman,
is a speech before the UN the right place to do that?
Well, we're going to talk about that in a little bit more detail. But going over, the president opened up the speech. Talking about Chris Stevens, the former ambassador to Libya, who was assassinated last week in just a horrific attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, Libya. He opened it up and painted a very honorable picture of Ambassador Stevens and his service in both the Peace Corps, then joining the Foreign Service with the State Department, working as a diplomat, very close to the folks in Benghazi as well as the Libyan people. But he says this because he says that Chris Stevens, quote-unquote, embodied the best of America. A lot of people are still criticizing the Obama administration for their handling on the aftermath of the assassination on Chris Stevens. Should he have used this as a basis to maybe say, look, we couldn't come out stronger. We will find you. We will find you. We will bring you to justice. You do not do this to Americans. Is that the right tone that he should be leading off with, particularly in a gathering, an international gathering like the General Assembly, Bob?
Well, I think a statement like that is probably best said out of the State Department. I don't think I think it's obvious that we will do something like that. But to me, I think it's interesting. I've read several recent follow-up stories to the about the assault, and I see where the government of Libya, obviously, and this is not a government which controls the entire country, has profoundly apologize for this apparently rebel group of militias. I gather there are militia groups all over the country, well armed, and some of them with one eye kind of ideas, some with other kind of ideas, but all of them kind of vying for political power. And this was one of the more radical groups, and apparently they have the military of Libya, that is the government's military, has gone into that base and has liquidated it. They have just gotten rid of it. They closed it up, and the people who were the killers of the ambassador and his staff, were either captured or ran for the hills. So I think the Libyan government is doing what they can do, and I don't see that in a speech where you're trying to reach broad issues like when you're talking to the UN. I'm not so sure that it isn't better to let the State Department talk about what has to be done, and let the president talk on the higher level, the, you know, the big themes he wants to express.
Well, come to Chanel, I mean, you know, there's some inside the Beltway and even outside the Beltway that criticize the Obama administration for not taking a more stronger stance in the attack in Benghazi that took Ambassador Stevens' life. This would have been an opportunity for the president to not so much flex his muscle, but to say, we will not tolerate this. This is not something that we will just stand idly by and watch. We will, in working with our foreign partners, we will take action and we will find justice. Did he miss the boat here?
I have no problem with him saying that or having the administration through some mechanism say that, but I don't think that the speech was the proper timing to do something of that tone. There got a lot of things going on up there that you can screw up by becoming bellicose at the wrong time.
Alan Moore.
I need to look back at the text. I think he did say that. And I didn't have any problem at all with him starting off talking about the ambassador, this young man in America who grew up in a particular place and parents were this, and he went into the Peace Corps and he served and in effect gave up his life. And he closed the speech by wrapping it, coming back around to say, it is let us make best let's pay tribute to this man by moving forward in the positive way that in view that he had. I do believe there was a reference to bringing these guys to justice, and also some words of that complimented Libya because the Libyans are horrified at what happened, and there have been some significant outpourings of support for America. It's not what we're seeing in Cairo, different situation. But my recollection is he did say something. This is not a time to sound all tough and harsh. He said that before too. We will, you know, make no mistake. We'll bring these guys to justice. But as we talked about last week, how do you do that? You got to be careful what you promise to do or say you're going to succeed in doing when it's thousands of miles away, different language, different culture. We don't have any police presence there. We sent some FBI agents over. They don't know who to talk to. They don't speak the language. They have to use translators. They don't have freedom of movement. I mean, it's really, really hard. And, you know, and Alice making the comment that I agree with. You can't just walk around talking tough if you've got nothing to back it up. I thought he took a fairly measured tone. You guys all know I can be pretty harsh critic of him, and there's plenty of ammunition for that. I didn't find the UN speech, though, as one of those big targets.
Ralph Woody.
You know, I think it was important to start out talking about the accomplishments of this ambassador because he was so beloved and so respected by the Libyan people, and to praise the Libyan government's efforts for going after the people that committed this horrific act. I think what people have come to me and mentioned is, how could something like this have happened in Libya when the NATO went in and took control of the country? There's still a lot of people that don't understand that large parts of the country are still not governable.
Well, there's going to be armchair quarterbacking on this particular subject down the road. But as far as the president speaks to the General Assembly, Bob, you know, traditionally we've seen a la President George Bush addressing prior to the Iraq invasion, you know, Khrushchev's tirade with his shoe pre-Cuban Missile Crisis. You know, this is an opportunity for a head of state to actually come in and state, you know, we will not be toyed with.
Sure.
Again, did Obama miss the boat here, Bob?
I don't think so. I think most of us around the table have said the same thing, that there are times to do that, but this probably is not the way to do it. And I think Alan is right. It's going to be a hard... I mean, the people who are going to find these guys, if they can, are not going to be the United States military. They're going to be the local people.
Right.
They're going to be the local people. And I think it's fair to say that the Libyan government has shown some real sorrow and remorse and regret over what has happened, and they are obviously trying to identify specifically which group of militia were the ones who were responsible. And it's clear to me that a lot of the population just genuinely cares about thanks the Americans for what they did for them, and they're unhappy about this and mad about it.
Congressman Al.
I don't know how Khrushchev's table, the shoe pounding, went over inside the Soviet Union, but he looked like a clown to everybody else.
The laughing stock.
Yeah.
So I don't know that that's a good example.
No. But you know, but we've seen other, you know, again, President George W. Bush's address to the General Assembly before the invasion of Iraq back in 2003.
No, I've forgotten. But was that particularly bellicose?
It wasn't saber rattling.
Not generally bellicose.
No, it wasn't saber rattling, but it had a very clear and distinct message of, you know, if X does not happen, Y will. And I think that that's something that we really didn't get a sense of here. And if we look deeper into it, you know, he did, going back to Alan's point, he did address Chris Stevens. He did address, you know, justice will be done at the end of his speech where he says, talking about the Libyan people, quote, they should remind us that as long as we work for it, justice will be done, that history is in our side, and that a rising tide of liberty will never be reversed, unquote. Again, very supportive of the Libyan people, which I think he should be. It just strikes me, though, that, you know, after we've seen, and it's not just Libya, we're talking about assaults on American embassies in Egypt, very, very, some say appeasing, some say very amicable to the new Egyptian government, which, depending on how you look at it, may or may not be a good idea. Alan Moore.
You know, this was, it seems to me, exactly not the time to try to sound tough, lay down conditions, preconditions for anything. He's trying to calm everybody down, and I certainly don't hold that against him. I did read, interestingly, in Libya, that a large group of hundreds of people, maybe more, carrying some pro-America signs, went into a militia camp somewhere around Benghazi, where the suspicion was that at least some of the heavily armed folks who attacked the consulate were, and went in there looking for trouble, burned buildings. Finally, Libyan forces came in and said, you guys got to get out of here, and then moved that whole militia camp out of there. I mean, one likes to think or hope that when something really horrible occurs, as did in Benghazi, that maybe some good can come out of it. It's certainly by no means always the case, and it doesn't justify or ever make things even. But it's been interesting to see that particularly in Libya, which is a kind of a unique case, that some pro-America response has begun to emerge. That doesn't mean they're going to love us and they'll change their minds in a week or a month or we'll do something to offend, but there was a lot of horror on the ground there, and that's a good thing. In terms of the president, as I think we all pretty much agree, this is a time to be calm and careful, not just because he's in the middle of a presidential campaign, but because this is a really volatile situation that we don't understand very well. We've got fledgling governments trying to establish their own bona fides, and some of the public is easily stirred up by grotesque images that people seem, for whatever reason, to choose to put up on the internet, and we have to live with the outcome.
Congressman Al.
Well, I'm still troubled by drawing a comparison with George Bush the First. George Bush the First was experienced in foreign policy. He had a very specific thing he was talking about, that was Iraq trying to take over Kuwait. Mm-hmm. And he had put together a real coalition, not like the one his son put together with a few people from a lot of little countries we never heard of. He had the major nations of the world backing him up, and he had a very specific military action that he could take. And you must remember that when he achieved that goal, he did not go to Baghdad, for which he was sharply criticized. I think it was the right decision. So this is just a totally different situation than President Obama faced.
Well, I guess the question is, if NATO had still been allowed to operate in Libya, would something like this have happened? I mean, would the Americans' diplomats been protected?
Well, again, we can armchair quarterback about that whole situation in Benghazi all day long, but in talking about the president's speech today, you know, we talk about him, you know, this is not the time or the place, but he did come out with some very tough words on Syria. In fact, he opened up by saying in Syria, quote, "The future must not belong to a dictator who massacres his people. If there's a cause that cries out for protest in the world today, it is a regime that tortures children and shoots rockets at apartment buildings," unquote. You know, there seems to be a dichotomy here that says, well, we'll be a little bit softer on the Libyans, on the Egyptians, but in Syria, we're going to show strong, strong, strong fist and stand up against this type of tyranny.
I don't see anything particularly strong in Syria. I see a lot of talking going on. Now, I'm not saying I think we ought to just go extend the Marines in, but the fact of the matter is the Syrian government is murdering its own people, probably maybe 15 or 20 million, 20,000 by now. Most of the Arab countries, which are Sunni, and the government, the majority of the population may be Sunni in Syria, but the government is a Shiite government. You know, these religious divisions in the Middle East are more important than anything else, you know, as far as their own groups believe that. You know. So we haven't done much at all in Syria, and I'm not saying we should, but the point is, if you want to find a place where something's really a mess going on in the world right now in the Middle East, Syria is about as bad as you can get.
Alan Moore.
I was reacting to an earlier comment that amused me from my good friend Al here, who talked about our allies in the Iraq War, a bunch of little countries he hadn't heard of, and I was wondering, which one of the following countries Al hadn't heard of? Was it the United Kingdom, or Australia, or Poland, or South Korea,
or Germany,
or Ukraine, or Netherlands, or Spain, or Georgia, or Italy? Which one of those?
Do you have the list of the Lilliputians that were?
Wow!
Qatar and Dubai.
Yeah.
Al.
Civility here. His father put together a real coalition.
Put a bigger coalition together. I was just taking
a little issue with
submissive comment about.
Number 10 Downing Street does not like to be referred to as a country nobody's ever heard of. just an inside out.
I should have said Great Britain and the Lilliputians.
The Lilliputians.
That are Germany, Australia,
Spain.
I moved.
Move to strike the last word.
Revise away, Al.
My work.
But what, you know, what we're looking at also is we're looking at a situation where, you know, the Palestinian-Israeli question. The president came out today and basically said that there has to be an independent Palestinian state that will accept living amongst an independent Jewish state, which did not sit well with many of the Jewish community here in the United States. Bob Hines, you look shocked by that.
I'm not shocked at all. What I'm pleased to see that the president says, let's have a little reality about this thing. You know, the reality is in the Middle East that the Israelis are there to stay unless they're overrun and nobody stops them. The Palestinians are there to stay unless somebody overruns them and there's nobody to stop them. The fact of the matter is they've got to learn to live together. And, you know, it isn't that hard. The biggest debate over there, if they want to destroy each other, then it's not going to happen. I mean, there's going to end up being just police actions for as long as we can all remember. But the fact of the matter is they have to figure out a way to divide the territory. And the question of the 67 borders, I think they are fundamentally the only substantive issue except the religious hatred. Right. And it's a relatively small decision. That and how to deal with Jerusalem are the only big issues that have to be dealt with.
The fact of the matter is the UN has really failed on this issue. I mean, since 1948. They should have come up with a plan years ago. And for the first time, you have Obama and the U.S. administration really coming out and saying, look, you have to have a create this Palestinian state. And it's getting a lot of people upset. But I'm glad that people are upset because it means that people are going to have to take a hard look at this issue and get it resolved.
Well, I mean, with less than 60 days before Election Day, Alan Moore, him coming out and calling for an independent Palestinian state, probably not going to bode well with certain Jewish communities in New York and South Florida and California.
They have been talking about this throughout this administration. This is not new. And the fact that it hasn't happened is not, in my mind, a failure of the United Nations. It's a failure of the two sides to find enough common ground to get to an agreement. That's been true for the last multiple of presidential administrations. Those who have focused hard, those who have focused less, they don't trust each other. They don't like each other, the two sides. The Palestinians can't speak with one voice. The Israelis have enough trouble speaking with one voice as we see their elections swing from the right to the left. So it's really hard to find people who can speak for and make good on any commitments. So they get super nervous. And there are a lot of practical problems on the ground. If you ever did create a separate state, how would you enforce the borders? What kinds of protections might there be for either side to know that the borders notwithstanding, they wouldn't be attacked? This is historical, long-term, intractable stuff. A lot of smart people have spent a lot of time and effort and an enormous amount of U.S. money trying to figure out a way to get a long-term solution, and about all we've been able to buy is temporary, more or less, willingness to live together.
You got to take it out of the hands of the radicals and put it in the hands of policymakers, decision makers, and create a homeland for the Palestinians. At the same time, ensuring the Israelis that their sovereignty is going to be respected. And that's really the key.
Congressman Al.
I want to compliment Alan on being able to say super nervous three times in a row. That's very
good, Alan. Okay. Well, you got that going for us. Super nervous.
Super nervous. That's hard to say.
I
did it right. I just
I wasn't aware of it. Oh, I see.
Yeah. when it comes to now, he did talk about he did address the situation with the anti-Muslim video that has been going around YouTube that arguably was the start of a lot of the uprisings occurring in Egypt, Yemen, and in Libya. The president basically came out, talked about our freedom of speech. He was very open about the fact that this is a liberty that we as Americans enjoy. But he basically said, look, you know, I, as the President of the United States, as the Commander-in-Chief, I know for a fact that I get called bad things by people in my own country all the time, and I will defend their right to do so. And, you know, we're not going to ban this video. We are a country of free speech. In short, and I'm going to paraphrase, like grossly paraphrase, hey, you guys might want to take a look at this. It's kind of cool. Is that a message that really resonates with the rest of the world, Alan Moore?
It doesn't resonate with them, but it is who we are and what we do, and so it's important for us to continue to remind people. It doesn't mean that everybody's going to have a little light bulb over their head and say, wow, what a great idea. I think they're going to say, wow, those Americans are really stupid, when all you would have to do is prohibit that behavior, and then you wouldn't have it, which is, of course, as we know, not a simple matter, not something you can do. We prohibit a few things, but very, very few.
Bob Hines.
I would like to see some of our friends around the world who also have fundamentally free speech and open speech, and, you know, you can say most of them anything. I'd like to see some other people besides us be the ones to carry that ball sometimes, particularly up in the UN. I mean, you look at all the European countries, you know, fundamentally, or you can say what you want to say. That's true in Latin America as well. It's true in Australia, New Zealand. There's a lot of countries like that. And it would be nice to see a few more of them start to talk about it, because what we're really talking about here is just, you know, if I say, you know, Muhammad is a turkey, I mean, I suppose if I said that someplace in the Middle East, somebody'd shoot me. But I don't, you know.
And by the way, they would be justified under the laws of certain countries
to do so. Yeah, and, you know, but the fact of the matter is, if one of them would say to me, Jesus was a phony, I'm not going to shoot him. I'm going to say, all right, you can say anything you want to do, but, you know, I ought to be able to say the same thing about your thoughts that you can say about mine. Get a little conversation going here.
Well, that brings up Ralph Winnie.
But the fact of the matter is, by becoming so incensed over this video, it actually encouraged and drove people to go and actually see what the video was all about. They had just sat back and said nothing. This video would not have gotten the coverage that it's gotten. If you remember Salman Rushdie and his book, Satanic Verses,
right?
It wouldn't have gone anywhere but the mullahs decided they were gonna put a fatwa. Right.
Yeah.
So everyone decides to go and buy the book,
and
the guy makes
money. Books by him ever since.
Right.
Yeah,
so,
absolutely.
You know.
But I guess the bigger question is, just going off the theme, you know, for those of us who saw it today, you know, great history lesson, great homage to Chris Stevens, a great diplomat in our foreign service that was taken from us very, very early. But, you know, again, in a situation like this, particularly with the tension that we're seeing, Iran, and that's going on in Iran, between Iran and Israel, the Palestinian question, and then the uncertainty of what's happening post-Arab Spring, I still think that there could have been an opportunity for them to say, we will stand with you, we will stand and support you, but however, when you come after us, we will take care of our own. Al, is that too much to ask, maybe? Or is this not the right venue?
I think it's not the right venue. I think it's the right policy, and I think that's largely the policy that we're following.
Alan Moore?
Mr. Moderator, we've been over this now multiple times. You keep pushing it, and we keep pushing back.
No, I don't need to push back on it.
We don't agree with you.
I got to try. Well,
But I do want to say something else about this week in Obama in New York, because I defend his speech. I read it. I thought it was appropriate and fine, nothing fabulous. But that was okay. No huge problems. What I do have a problem with is that this week, numerous scores of heads of state are in New York. Obama goes to New York, and this is a time historically where the president has a chance for some small, short, one-on-one meetings that can be very, very important in the relationship between the countries and between the individuals. The president had zero, not a single solitary one-on-one meeting. Now, the White House was saying, well, if you have one, then you have to have 10, and we don't have time. Well, you don't have time because why? You're coming to New York to give a speech. You didn't do that.
Right.
And go on the view. That's where I'm going. But, in other words, time to take off a few hours with your wife and go do the view, and a few days ago to go to New York and do a big fundraiser with Beyonce and Jay-Z, and then go to New York to do the Letterman show and go to California to do the Leno show. But a couple of meetings with heads of state at a very sensitive time, oh, sorry, we don't have the time. I think that's
the bigger story.
A fundamental failure of the week.
Interesting.
He didn't have the time because he was doing all those other things.
Yeah, well, exactly. And the latest quote coming out of the Obama camp was, he is eye candy, quote-unquote, for the folks on the view.
That's what he said.
I got to tell you something. Not something you want to hear a president call himself. Eye candy.
Yeah.
Not a big.
Even when you're joking, and it's I agree with you.
Oh my God! Well, when we come back, we're going to talk about the week that Mitt Romney had versus the week that Mitt Romney is having right now. This is Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington D.C. We will be back in 4 minutes. Stay with us.
You know, here on Backroom Politics, you hear us order drinks during happy hour, the second hour of Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio. But what you don't understand is the quality of the drink that we're getting here at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Backroom Politics premier sponsor. Hey, you got Dave Hammerly and the bar crew there at Shelley's Back Room that really know how to pour a drink. Whether it's something simple like my on-air Jack Daniels on the rocks with a splash of water, or whether it's something elaborate like what has to be the best martini in the District of Columbia for Congressman Al Swift. Wine selection, scotch selection that will blow your mind. They've got Highland scotches, they've got Isle of Skye scotches, blended, single malt, anything you want. Port wines to go with that great cigar from the great humidor. Down here at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Come on down, have a drink, and make some new friends. Or heck, just come on down and listen to Backroom Politics on Tuesdays.
Room 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., and what's turning out to be a very nice sunny day here in the Penn Quarter, right two blocks from the White House. We're going to talk a little bit now about the week that Mitt Romney had last week versus the week he's starting off to have this week. You have to look at it, Bob Hines, and if you're Mitt Romney, last week couldn't get over quick enough, could it?
No, the only thing he wasn't accused of last week was being an axe murderer.
Good observation.
Well, we just haven't heard about that yet.
Yeah. Gibbs came out and said he might be accused of that, but yeah. It was close. Why was it such a bad week for Romney? Talked a little bit about last week, but we didn't see the further gaps that would happen in the Romney camp. It was a really bad week for the Romney folks.
Well, you know, it was tough because he does have a way of saying things that is not the way you would say them if you thought about it a little bit longer.
Or as he puts it, I didn't articulate that very well.
Yeah, well, that's a nice way to put it. But, you know, when you say some of the things he said, it is difficult to clean it up. I mean, saying 47% of the people are takers, it's not a very good way to deal with half the country.
But Alan Moore, he didn't double down. I mean, he literally just went all in on that and didn't back down.
I disagree.
How's that?
He did not apologize. He said, I did not explain myself very well. And he was disassociating himself from that 47% figure, which was on its face ridiculous and problematic. And the last thing he wanted to do was try to, in effect, divorce himself from big chunks of that 47%, like retirees who live on Social Security or on pensions, whatever. They're no longer paying taxes, but they're living on income, and many cases from the government by itself. He simply said, I did not explain myself well, and he's tried to re-explain. The problem is, the words are out there. The words are fairly clear. He's got to live with them, and it's awfully hard to say, oops, my bad, what I meant was this. So I think he felt that, this word apology tends to be tossed around as some sort of sign of weakness. He didn't want to apologize for views that he would acknowledge he has, so he's got to say, no, that's not what I meant. I meant something very different. I do care enormously about those people, even though I'm guessing they're probably not, many of them are not going to vote for me. And so that's why I reject the notion that he doubled down. He didn't say, oh yeah, that's what I think. He moved in a very different direction to redefine.
Congressman Al, you take the same viewpoint on that, or do you think he really went all in, saying, "Hey, you know, this is my point. If you don't like it, don't vote for it."
I think he. President Obama, what was his great line?
You didn't build that.
That isn't exactly what he meant in context. This isn't what Mitt Romney meant. The words are out there, and we will continue to hear them on both sides. But the fact is, if you really want to understand what either candidate means, you need to go deeper than just the words that the opponents will keep throwing at
them. Yeah. Bottom line?
I couldn't agree more. I mean, it's simple as that. If the words are out there, he's going to have to live with it. But the fact of the matter is, it's a problem. It's a problem. It's easy for those who wish to denigrate him to keep putting it out, and they will.
But we talked about it briefly last week, but I want to go further in because it was a subject that came out later in the week as a talking point to most of the pundits on the Talking Head shows, is that can Romney really be faulted for saying what he said in a private dinner with donors, and not just donors, but big money donors that are core Republican supporters?
When you are campaigning, everything you say, you're on. You're on whether you know it or not. You have to understand it that way. You have to talk, understanding that anything and everything you say is free, open shots.
And I can tell you from experience that the most dangerous time for a candidate, the time when he's really got to watch what he says, is when you're talking to people who agree with you on everything and you're trying to throw them a little raw meat.
Yeah.
And that's probably why both Obama and Romney made the remarks.
I think if Romney is going to win this thing, he's going to have to start showing empathy, a connection with the American people. One of Reagan's greatest strengths was his ability to make people feel good about themselves, a belief in this country and their ability to be able to achieve greatness. and by, in effect, attacking a certain class of people, Romney has engaged in form of class warfare that the Democrats are trying to use against him now.
Alan Moore.
And in terms of things that Obama has done, these politicians never seem to learn from the mistakes of others. Obama's big mistake 4 years ago that lived on and resonated and probably cost him some votes, it's just he was so far ahead of McCain he could afford to give up a few, was when he was out in San Francisco with a small group of donors and asked, you know, how do you connect with the people out in some of those swing states, and I think it was Pennsylvania was the reference he made. You know, some of those rural white voters retreat to their guns and their Bibles and don't really take to people who are different from them. Oh my God, that lived on, and you still see that quote come up. You know, it wasn't a terrible, horrible thing to say. It was kind of a reflective comment, but it made him sound like he was elitist and putting them down, which in a little bit of a way he probably was. And in the case, I think, of Romney, he's with a group of people. He kind of lets his hair down. He gets careless with his words, conflates 47% who pay no federal income tax with this other number, throws them all into the same little box, which is fundamentally inaccurate, and they are words that he will spend a lot of time explaining, not just between now and the debates, during the debates and beyond, because he's going to see them over and over again thrown back at him in campaign ad after campaign ad.
But which is more prevalent right now? Because it seems to me that for all the media attention that's being driven on Romney's flukes, flubs, whatever you want to call them this week, Congress for now, we're not seeing the tenacity of the Obama campaign that we may have seen in 2008. It's almost a risk-averse campaign, a lot of vague statements, some call it placating, some call it appeasement, whatever you will call it. There's not that energy that you see in 2008 Obama. Which is more prevalent in the two of those?
Well, I got to tell you, I would love to know the inner workings of either one of these campaigns. I think they are two of the worst presidential campaigns I've ever seen. Too loose, too many flubs, too many, in the case of Obama, I think you're right, letting too many things pass by that he should have left on. And in Romney's case, sometimes he jumps too fast on some things that should be exploited, but he doesn't exploit them very well.
But Alan Moore, go ahead.
These guys, remember, are watching polling data and focus groups, and they will pivot, not in 90-degree turns, but in 5 and 10-degree turns. Not very long ago, the president and others were trashing constantly millionaires and billionaires. That was the phrase. They need to pay their fair share. You don't hear that as much. It's an undercurrent of stuff, but there are a lot of people who have $1 million worth of assets and are not all that, not feeling all that flush and all that wealthy, and their income isn't all that high. They've been lucky and they're older and they've got equity in homes and 401k plans and stuff like that. And they started to back down from that because they were taking flack from donors. They make those shifts. They stop. They back off Romney when he's damaging himself.
Almost the Napoleon-esque of never interrupt your enemy when he's making a mistake.
Absolutely. And they also look at the polls and they're watching what's happening. And as things are trending up for them, they become more careful and a little more cautious. Meanwhile, you're seeing a little more assertive and aggressive Romney because he's showing weakness in some of these key swing states. So when the president said yesterday in an interview that in the Middle East we knew there were going to be bumps in the road along with, you know, the way of some of these democratic movements. Well, Romney jumped all over him and said, how do you dare you call the murder of an ambassador a simple bump in the road? Well, that's not. I don't blame Romney for jumping because he's got to jump on something, and the Obama people pushed back and said, you know, apples and oranges. It's not, we're not in any way minimizing the importance of that. But these campaigns watch, they shift, they respond, not so much to what party members are saying or to what pundits are saying, but to what their own sense of what's going on in the electorate, state by state, as shows up in the
polls. But, Bob, I've heard some Republicans here local talk about the fact that what Romney has is the energy, the aggressiveness that should be seen in a presidential campaign midterm, but a liberally slanted media that he doesn't have supporting him, but will support the vagueness and the risk averseness of the Obama campaign. Is that fair?
The media is just reflecting, you know, somebody talks to somebody inside a campaign and they say something about what they're doing, and they denigrate something the other side is doing, and you write a story about it. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. I mean, I have seen stories in the last several days about apparently some Republicans starting to pull away, or will they pull away from Romney? Will the big donors, Karl Rove and others, the guys who are raising lots of money,
the Republican super PACs?
That's right. If they see that Romney doesn't turn it around pretty quickly, they're going to stop, or they're going to reduce the money they're putting in his campaign and give it to senatorial races, give it to congressional races.
We're not seeing that though.
All I'm saying to you is, what you're seeing is, you're seeing stories talking about this is going to happen if Romney doesn't make a big move. Now, you know, that's the kind of speculation you see all the time, and it's, is it wrong, is it right? No, it's just speculation going on.
But, Ralph, what
I was going to say, and now you're seeing Peggy Noonan and Bill Kristol coming out openly saying the Romney campaign is in trouble, and they need to rework the strategy. So it's not just the liberal media anymore.
Well, arguably, Bill Kristol's never been a Romney fan from day one. I mean, you know, Kristol's been critical of Romney's candidacy from the beginning, not being true to the ideals. He is what they call a rhino, a Republican in name only. However, though, to go to that, you know, we have seen some in the Republican media come out and saying that Romney's not the right guy, we're screwed, we're not going to see a Republican president for another 4 years. But going back to looking at what Obama's doing, you know, Obama had the situation with the teacher strike in Chicago, not very well played by a lot of the insiders that look at it from a pro-union supportive view, and you had your former chief of staff going against a union that has largely backed Obama from day one. We're seeing a lot of missteps on the Obama campaign that aren't really getting highlighted. It just seems that perhaps, Alan Moore, the Romney flubs are that much greater, better, more visible.
As we said before, it was a bad week. There were a couple of things at exactly the wrong time, exactly the wrong way. They sort of fed a narrative. One thing I found interesting last week, it was on Friday that he released the actual tax return for FY 2011. He had put out some estimated information, and he put out the 379 page return, and I think there was, you know, a number of interesting things in it. And the two biggest things is that the overwhelming majority of his income comes from capital gains and from stock dividends, both of which are taxed at a maximum of 15%. And then it's also interesting that he gave almost 30% of his income away.
Right.
About $4 million. But he didn't deduct all of it in order to preserve an overall tax rate on adjusted gross income of 14%.
I mean, which, by the way, is higher than the liability he had.
That's right. I mean, that's my point. He gave away about $4 million, and he only deducted about $2.3 million of it because he just didn't want to have to explain why his effective tax rate on adjusted gross income was less than the 14.1%. I mean, it's bizarre stuff. The thing that has gotten very little coverage, though, that I found fascinating was that in addition to the 379 pages of tax return with, you know, his $13.5 million of income and the taxes that he paid and state and local taxes and all that, was this summary that he asked his accountants to do of the previous 11 years, where they said that in none of those years was his federal income tax liability less than 13%, and that his average was higher than that. And it gave kind of summary data to put, at least in his hope, to bed this question that he's got all sorts of things to hide and conceal, and that he must have had zero tax payment years. And unless one thinks that PricewaterhouseCoopers is a bunch of liars, then it was a pretty interesting piece of information put out that got virtually no news attention.
Bob Hines and Al Swift.
And I thought one of the things I found interesting was one of the Pricewaterhouse vice presidents, in writing some notes down, you know, in some of the documents, pointed out that he, meaning Mr. Romney, had in his filings and in his workings with his taxes, had not gone into any esoteric areas and really unusual things. It was just mainly that he's got 90% of his income or more comes from income which is only taxed at 15%, even if you don't have very much of it. I mean, my dividends are would only be taxed at that level. I mean, it's just a normal thing. It's the point that was being made was, yes, he is using tax. Most of his income is taxable in low rates because of the kind of income it is. But he did not go into any lot of esoteric types of effort in order to hide or delay taxes. He just was operating on the fact that he has a lot of money that comes that way, as opposed to me, who has maybe a few thousand dollars of interest in dividends.
But Congressman, I'll work on you on this one. You served in Congress. You had to deal with the polling data that came in. It seems like every day we're seeing new polling data. And the data in general doesn't change. We are in a presidential race that nationwide is arguably within the margin of error, depending on who you listen to or watch. But when we talk about the swing states, one Washington Post poll has Obama up 8 points in Ohio, up 4 in Florida. That's big news, but they don't talk about the overall general average. Are we focusing too much, and are we running presidential campaigns strictly based on polling data? Have we lost reality with the issue versus the polls?
2 points, going back just a little bit. Having seen what he has now revealed, I cannot figure out for the life of me why he didn't do it sooner. There wasn't anything in there that was arrows with the heart at all, and he took a lot of crap before he finally did something that it seems to me he should have done right at the outset and avoided doing it. Now, with regard to the other thing, I think that American politics is run too much by the professional campaign politicians and not enough by the people who make policy. And I think that oftentimes these guys don't really know what they're doing. They don't know. They read the polls and they make this adjustment and that adjustment, and they leave the candidate often seeming to contradict himself and so forth. So yes, I think we are following polls too much, but it's the campaign professionals that are doing that. They have they say we know how to win an election, and it is by doing this, and they screw up a lot of what a normal campaign would look like if they were in fact merely advisors rather than running the show.
Bob Hines, is this a dangerous path that we're following when we look at all these polling data that are coming out and everybody polling the way they are?
I don't think it's dangerous. I think it's unfortunate. That, you know, it's not dangerous in that sense. It's you're not going to change the fact that there are always going to be people out there in the community of campaign experts who know how to poll, know how to ask the kind of questions that get to the underlying what people really think and why they get to where they do think something. They're very good at that kind of stuff. But those people are, you know, they're almost overwhelming the policy people who are trying to figure out how to talk about the policy issues. You know, everybody knows what the solutions are to some of the financial problems, the fiscal problems the government has. It's going to be very interesting to hear the president and Mr. Romney talking about, I'd be interested to see what happens if either one of them say anything nice about Bowles Simpson.
Well, let me ask this question.
As an example.
Is what you're saying basically that the polls are driving the issues now?
I think the polls are driving too much of the campaign decisions.
Really?
Yeah.
They're not driving the issues that are being... I mean, by this time, normally, in any presidential campaign previous to this year, we would have seen white paper after white paper being issued
on
solutions.
And you haven't seen any.
We haven't seen that.
It's going to be interesting to see how much is people start saying when there's one-on-one talking about deficit reduction, what are you going to do, Mr. President? What are you going to do, Mr. Romney, to see what either one of them say?
Al Swift.
The reason that you haven't seen white papers and all of that is because the campaign professionals know that anything you say can be picked apart.
Absolutely.
And it can be misinterpreted and can be turned into something that it's not. So they think you're better off if you don't say anything on policy.
Alan Moore.
The problem is not that there aren't any white papers. Nobody reads these white papers because they're so devoid of real meat, or they're highly complicated. I mean, Romney, many, many months ago, put out his 59-point tax plan. None of us know. I mean, I could probably recite three or four things there. And he talks about tax reform without specifics. But if you start talking specifics, you get hammered. Now, the president, he puts out a budget every year. And even though both houses of Congress reject it unanimously, at least there's something that's out there. But he's not talking about it, and that's only one year at a time. The tough, hard decisions that the public, sorry public, doesn't really understand and doesn't have a lot of appetite for are the long-term getting a handle on budget deficits by increasing revenue and scaling back spending on the entitlement programs and defense, entitlements meaning Medicare, Social Security, and Medicaid. The more you dig into the weeds, the more you're willing to sort of acknowledge that things are on the table, the more you're likely to get hammered. So you don't go out there to gratuitously do political harm to yourself.
Congressman Al.
We said on this program months ago that the only way you're going to resolve this budget problem is by Republicans and Democrats holding hands and jumping into the mess together so that they can't use it against each other. And it's wholly unrealistic to expect that to happen now at this point.
We're going to talk about that here in the next segment because that's a lead into our discussion on civility. Ralph Winning.
Just one last point on Romney's tax returns. If you saw the 60 Minutes interview, the reporter asked him if Romney thought it was fair that he, Romney, only paid 14% and someone who makes $50,000 pays a much higher tax rate. What Romney said is it's already been taxed once at the corporate level. Now, what's interesting is the Democrats are going back to check and see whether Bain was, in fact, a corporation at the time that Romney is filing these tax returns. If it was not, if it was a partnership, Romney should not have paid 14%. He should have paid a higher tax rate.
interesting point.
Right.
But I want to go back to Romney's good week starting off, though. Romney had a strong showing today at the Clinton Global Initiative, where he received a standing ovation for his comments, a very definitive, globalized view of where he sees America going. Is that a testament to his foreign policy experience? Some say he doesn't have it. Or is that just something that he finally is getting into his groove, he's being prepped, he's ready to go to these events, he's now bringing his A game a little too late, though? Bob Hines.
I would hope it's the latter. I am aware that in recent times, people like Jim Baker have been called up. And he's talking to some people who are not integral parts of his campaign, but they are, you know,
sage advisors within the party.
Sage advisors who probably know more about foreign policy or other issues than almost anybody else. And I think that's smart. I think he is realizing that he needed some a little more advice and counsel, and he's getting it. I hope he pays attention to it, because there are very few people that I have more respect for than Jim Baker, as a man who understands the issues and knows how to handle them.
I mean, arguably Romney went in Alan Moore today to the lion's den by appearing on MSNBC in a one-on-one town hall interview with Brian Williams, talking about education. A lot of Republicans talking, we don't need a federal Department of Education. We don't need... we need to put the power back to the district and to the state levels. He went right into the lion's den. It was very, very clear and well-received in New York City, where there's a strong teachers' union. He came out and said, look, the presidential campaigns should receive no money from teachers' unions, but also was very supportive of Secretary of Education Arne Duncan. Again, was he prepped right? Is he now just starting to bring his A game?
I didn't hear what he had to say. I simply saw that he did well with Clinton and that he did well on MSNBC. He has, depending on what the subject matter is and what the format is, he can have better and worse days. He's also learned. You learn when you do this stuff. The highly controversial, problematic remarks from the fundraiser that everybody talked about all last week and still do was from May. I'm not saying that May, he shouldn't have known better, but May was May, and this is now September. And from May to December, as they say, a lot of things happen. You learn, you refine your points, you become more precise, more careful, you fix old mistakes, you try to respond to events as they're unfolding. So I think that the fact that he was funny and also relevant and on point with Clinton worked out very well, because that will get a lot of coverage when he can talk about, hey, I'm looking forward to my Clinton bump. Whenever you're with Bill Clinton, you want some of that Clinton magic to rub off.
And, absolutely.
And it's a sort of a generous comment, generous statement. People laugh about it. They talk about it. They say, okay, he can be a regular guy.
All right. We got to go to break here real quick, because we're overtime on this one. We're gonna take a break. When we come back, I want to do a real quick segment on, not a real quick segment, actually a detailed segment on civility in politics, something that we've talked about numerous times on this show. However, the Scott Brown, Liz Warren war is heating up in Massachusetts. That was supposed to be one of the big focal points of political civility in the election cycle. We'll talk about that when we come back. This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. God bless you. We'll be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us.
Wow, a little bit of Fats Waller. Lulu back in town. And I tell you, when I am back in town, or when any of my friends are back in town, or heck, when we're living here in town, we usually find ourselves down at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., right across from the National Press Club. Why do we come here? Well, they've got the city's best cigar menu. the most diversified, with some of the best-known brands and some that you might even know, but you might want to give it a try. Everything from Arturo Fuentes down to Zeno. You can go all the way from your $9 little petite girly flavored cigars all the way up to the Opus X Lost City. They have a cigar for everybody. Mild, medium, strong, heavy. However you want to smoke it, it's available here at Shelly's Back Room. Come in, have Bob, Na, or any one of the girls show you what the right cigar might be for your taste that evening. Again, Shelly's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. As Bob likes to put it, it is definitely the place to be.
You can tell the mailman not to call. I ain't coming home until the fall. And again, I might not get back home at all. Lula's back in town, yeah.
Shelly's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio. We're going to switch gears here for a little bit and talk about an overarching subject that it's troubled us from the onset of this radio show. All of us around the table have been adamant supporters of the concept of bringing civility back to politics. And by the way, it's happy hour. It's time for us to order our drinks, cut open our cigars, and get ready for this discussion. Alan Moore, go ahead and do the order. We bring up this topic today. By the way, I'll have a Jack on the Rocks splash of water, please.
My usual martini.
Al's usual martini. Bob's going to have his glass of Merlot. There it is. We're going to talk about this today, and the reason why I'm bringing it up is what was supposed to be a staple, what was supposed to be a focal point of civility in politics, talking about the issues, talking about the pros and cons of each candidate, but in a civil manner. We're talking about the Massachusetts U.S. Senate race between current Senator Scott Brown and Elizabeth Warren, who's the Democratic contender for that same seat. They had originally come together and agreed that this was going to be a civil campaign. No negative advertising. It just basically stated on the facts and the ideals of the campaign. Well, as of last week, that little gentleman's agreement or gentlewoman's agreement has since gone south with the release by Scott Brown's campaign of several ads questioning her comments about being a Native American and how she used that for benefit in government service. The Warren camp has put out several scathing ads regarding Scott Brown. I think the only thing they didn't do was show the old GQ underwear model photos of Scott Brown. But it has now, in the past 7 days, gotten really nasty. I bring this up because at a time where we were so hopeful, we had our fingers crossed that the Massachusetts Senate campaign could be done on a basis of civility, right before the triggers pulled, they go south and they go negative. Bob, I'm going to start with you. Why is civility in politics not viable today?
Well, first of all, let's distinguish between running a campaign and in the legislature, okay?
Okay.
All right. The reason you see this, let's assume for the purpose of this discussion that one of these two candidates, Mr. Brown or Ms. Warren, were 10 points ahead. This, you know, might not have happened. The one behind might say, I can't possibly catch up, so, you know, I'll be nice about it. The fact of the matter is, you have a campaign where both sides are running neck and neck in the state. It's about a point or two difference, and it depends which poll you read, but they're both, it's just tight as it can be. So they're going with you know, the kitchen sink, so to speak. You know, throw this kitchen sink in, you know, I can't win any other way. It's too close. Let's go for it. That's what's going on.
But why is it that we have gotten to this point? Whereas even when the agreement between the two camps say
want to win,
is winning obviously important in all
it's
this?
It's the only thing.
And we're now at a stage in politics, Alan Moore, that we can't see civility even in campaigning.
At least of all
in campaigning.
That was fighting sarcasm, Alan.
This is not beanbag. It's hand grenade.
This is not a new place for America. I was reflecting on 1982. I was working in the U.S. Senate for John Danforth from Missouri. He started out that campaign with 90% approval, and his opponent was somebody who was unknown. But it was a very, very tough year economically, and what turned out to be a very tough year for Republicans. And his opponent chipped away at him by going negative from the outset, had little to say about her own record or her own self, just basically said, well, John Danforth talks a good game, but let's look at the facts, as she called them. And painted a negative picture. And in a tough economic period, the people of Missouri began to think, yeah, I'm not so happy with things. Maybe he isn't all that great. We got closer and closer and closer and closer to the end. And finally, Danforth, who resisted and resisted and resisted going negative, was finally persuaded about 10 days out, 2 weeks out, well, maybe we'll cut a couple of ads. And he ended up going negative. He hated doing it. But he hated even worse the thought that he wouldn't respond in a way that could win, and he won. He pulled out a victory with all the momentum having shifted. People go negative because it worked. In the case of Massachusetts, what those guys agreed to was they would urge outsiders from coming in. Stay out, stay out, stay out, stay out. And the outsiders respected that. I don't know if they will respect it all the way to the end. I think it was a different kind of commitment about whether they would go negative. They started to go after each other in a debate. I think it was Elizabeth Warren who went first negative, but they both were ready because it's a close race. Brown was up a little, Warren's up a little. You want to win first and foremost.
Rob Whitting. Yeah.
I think Brown was running a campaign of bipartisanship, talking about all the Democrats that he worked with and how he was getting legislation passed. I think it shocked him that even though he was bipartisan, he was still he was falling behind Elizabeth Warren in this race, and he was not getting a lot of support among the Democrats or the base, and figured the only way to win was to start going negative. And that's unfortunate because he was running a very positive campaign.
But elsewhere, you know, you've said before that one of the things that troubled you, you swore you wouldn't, A, use political operatives in the running of your campaigns for Congress. You didn't do that until your last successful run before you retired. You swore that you would not necessarily go truly negative on your opponent, and you stood by that. Are we in a different time now that something like that you can't win without having a negative?
I stood by that until the very end. And I did something that just outraged my staff director because she said, you're going to ruin your reputation as an honest person. But it seemed like it was necessary. I didn't actually make those commitments publicly. I just never used
these. These were internal commitments, but these are commitments that you made in you, the running of your campaign.
But at the very end of the campaign, my opponent started a whole series of radio ads talking about me voting myself a pay increase. Now that's a dynamite issue. People don't understand that Congress would still be getting paid what they were paid 200 years ago if Congress didn't vote themselves a pay increase, because you've got to pass a law to do it. It's the only way they get a pay increase. Yeah. So you can't explain that away. So what we did, because my opponent was kind of a screwball and he had been the only person in the state legislature to vote against an anti-pornography bill, and I know the man wasn't for pornography, but he had his own reasons, and he was kind of screwed. So we did a mailer with a cute little boy with a Dutch bob with his back standing in front of a store that looked like an adult store. It wasn't, you couldn't see anything in it, but boy, these guys put together a picture that really left a strong impression. And I approved it in black and white over the objections, as I said, of my staff. Then they printed it in an off green and a purple, which was just revolting. And we sent it out to 20,000 people. That's all. Just 20,000. But they were all young mothers. You know, direct mail people can now zero in.
Micro-target.
Yeah. Well, I don't happen to think that that really won the election for me. What happened was that my opponent saw these things, somebody brought them to his attention, he thought they'd gone out to everybody. And he pulled all of his, Swift took a pay increase, and put on the radio ads about how much he loved children. And as a result, I think he lost the advantage of his negative thing, because he responded to my negative thing. Am I proud of that? No. I find it a very interesting development, but no. But he was winning, and I thought on an extremely unfair issue, you needed to take a sledgehammer to it in order to win, and I did, and I won, and as I said, I'm not proud of it, but I'm proud that I won.
Well, okay, but even then, I mean, that mailer by today's standards is tame compared to a lot of the advertisement and a lot of the rhetoric we're seeing put out there. And for full disclosure, you know, I ran a campaign recently. I went negative. I freely admit that. It has to be done.
It works.
It works, unfortunately. But are we so far down the road, Bob Hines, that we're never going to be able to make that turn back?
I don't know, number one. I just don't. I do think that the effort that Senator Brown and Ms. Warren made to try to stay positive and argue with the merits of the case rather than go negative has worked fairly well for a long time during that campaign. It isn't until the last, you know, 3 weeks, a month or so that they have gone somewhat negative. It's not, you look at some of the things that they're saying that are quote negative, and boy, they're almost as mild as what Al is talking about of something that was 20 years ago. The fact of the matter is, I think that you can always have some positives. You hope that people will be positive, but there are most of the gals and the guys who do your advertising almost inevitably will tell you if you're a candidate, you have to go negative. and they want, you've got to define the other guy before he can define himself.
But Alan Moore, you're a veteran of many campaigns. You know, I know for a fact that, you know, you hear people, oh, I don't like negative campaigns. I can't stand it when I see those negative ads. But they're effective. Where's the disconnect?
Well, it cuts both ways. Some people just tune them out. I mean, we're seeing a lot of ads now in the Virginia area for the Virginia Senate race, for the presidential race, because Virginia is a swing state. So we see constant barrages of anti-Obama, anti-Romney messages from each other's campaign, from the third-party PACs. We just see it constantly, and you kind of hear it once or twice, then you tend to tune out. They, state by state or congressional district by congressional district, are microcosms of what we now see nationally. If 45% of the people are going to vote for Romney and 45% are going to vote for Obama, or 47 and for whatever those numbers are, they're aiming for that swing group in the middle, and in the case of the president, they're looking at the swing states. It's no different in Al's congressional district. He had people who like him and know him and are going to vote for him, and his opponent had people who were simply going to vote for the candidate of the other party. But there's a group in the middle. You want to persuade them one way or the other they should vote for you or against the other guy in favor of you, or sit home because they don't like the other guy, whether they're going to work for you. There's different ways that these things can help. It is a proven fact that going negative at an appropriate time will oftentimes may make the difference in a close call. So you have to have everything in your arsenal and then make a judgment at the time. Sometimes it backfires. There are negative campaigns from time to time that turn people off. The press gets mad. Other people get angry. And some of the people that you thought were for you suddenly say, I'm not going to vote for him because of what he said about his opponent. And so it's not just a free shot that you can go negative with impunity. You have to be subtle. You have to be careful. Your timing has to be right. That's where all these fancy advisors come in.
Bob Ein.
I want to touch on something Alan said about so often, you know, when the campaigns are close, there's just a few percentage of the voters that you're trying to influence. Virginia, in this presidential election, is a perfect example of what's going on. Number one, in that race, it's fairly close in Virginia. And interestingly enough, there is a third party candidate who is getting about 2% of the vote on most of the polls. He's a former congressman by the name of Virgil Goode. He is from the southern portion of the state, pretty conservative guy, Tea Party type, and he is getting 2%. Now, figure just for a moment, think about that. If you are the Republican candidate, Mr. Romney, now you got to figure that a guy who is a Tea Party former congressman is very conservative. They're not going to be voting for the president. They may not be voting for anybody if Mr. Goode wasn't in the race, but they're most likely to go at least, 3 or 4 to 1 for Mr. Romney if Mr. Goode wasn't in the race. Now, so it's that narrow percentage is really vital, as Alan says, the best thing that could happen to Mr. Romney in Virginia is not that he might have this brilliant negative ad about Mr. Obama. It's if Mr. Goode would suddenly get out of the race. That would give him 2% right there. He doesn't have.
Ralph Woody, then Congressman Al.
I was just gonna say, when you have a horribly negative ad, like what Alan Grayson did in going after Dan Webster, the Taliban dam, which was totally false.
Correct.
American people, and I think, will just totally rebel and vote for the other candidate. But if there's any shades of truth to any of this negativity, I mean, they're not going to just automatically vote for the other guy. They will stick with the person that when they get it.
Congressman Al.
The basic answer to your question, I think, rests in human nature. I think people kind of like to believe, it's like gossip, know, they like to believe that, have you heard that so-and-so, you know, was sleeping with a milkman? And it spreads, and people like that kind of crap. And I don't know how you overcome human nature. You got to remember that negative campaigning didn't start with Obama and Mr. Romney. It started back when the country was founded. Thomas Jefferson, when he was Secretary of State, hired a guy to write a lot of crap about George Washington.
Who was his boss?
Who was his boss, and he was supposed to be part of Washington's team. And he was out there undercutting it because he didn't agree with certain things that may have been even then thinking of running for president. So it's always been there.
But is that, let me just jump in here real quick. Is that just taking the president to task for issues? Or is that what we see, the mudslinging negative that we see today?
That was... What was similar to today was that it was very, very trashy stuff.
Look,
it wasn't a reasoned argument against it. He was out doing real.
Was there any truth to it at the time?
From what I understand, no.
Oh, okay.
Alan Moore.
Yeah, I'm just, you know, again, leaping forward 150 years. In 1960, which was the first campaign I ever paid any attention to, I was in high school at the time. The quiet, whispered accusation that would show up in bumper stickers and talk was John Kennedy's Catholicism. And I remember the bumper sticker: "Eliminate the middleman, vote for Pope John the 23rd, or Pope Pius, whoever was Pope at the time. Vote for the Pope." It was ugly, scurrilous stuff, and there was just a lot of anti-Catholic material that was out there. It was really, really gross, ugly stuff. And then in '64, you had Johnson versus Goldwater, and the famous little girl looking at the flower with the nuclear mushroom cloud going off behind her. And the notion was, Barry Goldwater cannot be trusted with his finger on the nuclear bomb.
I mean,
isn't a policy issue. This is like just taking some little fact or some tough talk and expanding it into this grotesque thing.
Well, you're talking,
putting that on television.
One could argue that Ronald Reagan's Bear commercial back in 1980, was that seen as negative, or was that seen as a policy shot? The walking bear is there. It was definitely a targeted at Carter's foreign policy and his handling of the Soviet, but was it negative?
When you talk about somebody other than yourself and what you can do and what you will do, and instead choose to talk about in metaphor or direct accusation about your opponent, by its nature, by definition, it's negative. If I'm going to pay, or my allies are going to pay, to talk about my opponent, it is by definition going to be a negative ad. And there are grotesque, over-the-top negative ads. Ralph mentioned one that had a big backlash. So you try to go as far as you can. You don't want the backlash, but it's definitely negative. It's trying to define the other person.
Congressman, now,
let's make a distinction between a negative ad that is on issues and explains where you disagree, as opposed to a scurrilous ad such as the Swift Boat ads, which basically said that a war hero was in fact
a coward.
That I consider to be a vicious, unacceptable negative ad. The Bear ad, I thought, was a brilliant piece of a way of explaining how Reagan differed with Jimmy Carter. And I would say negative, sure. Bad, no.
Alan Moore.
I agree with Al. Just all negative ads aren't bad somehow, or over the top, or exaggerated. I mean, that's part of what you do is you create a contrast, and you create the contrast by saying, here's me, and here's the other guy. And how far you go in painting the other picture determines the underlying sort of morality or ethics of it. But you're creating this contrast, and you're putting yourself in the best light and the other person in a negative.
But Bob Hines, it seems like those lines are either blurred, or is it that today's electorate can't make that distinction anymore?
The lines are flexible.
Are they?
Yes. It's not always clear, but the fact of the matter is you can distinguish between negative ads that are fair and the negative ads that are play fast and loose with the truth.
So where's the line?
Well, the line ought to be a negative ad that says my opponent voted three times to do something it's a negative ad, but it's perfectly legitimate. But to say my opponent is a weasel and he's a weasel because of this and that, and they make something up, that's different. You can't, but it's fair to say that negative ads are of two types, at least. Some of them are legitimate. You talk about someone's record, and when that person made that vote or two votes, it may have been perfectly reasonable. It's turned out to be a very bad idea, and now you can use that against that person for making the same judgment a lot of other people made. And now the public has changed its mind. That's different than doing something scurrilous, and people do more. It's most of the negative ads are rather scurrilous.
Ralph Winnie.
If you remember 1988, the whole Willie Horton ad, and I would ask Bob, where would you put that on the whole scale of civility?
That's a tough question because
I know where I would do it.
I know where.
Well, let's talk about it. Bob, mind you first.
Let's remind everybody what the Willie Horton.
Yeah, the Willie Horton ad. For those of you out in Radio Land who are listening, it was a ad put out by the George Walker Bush. Or Herbert Walker Bush
Herbert
campaign
Walker
in
Bush
1988. It was an attack ad, as many called it, against then Governor Michael Dukakis. The basis of the ad was that Willie Horton, who was let out on furlough, a known sex offender
and murderer,
was let out on furlough due to a Dukakis policy and went out and killed a young woman. And that ad became known as the Willie Horton ad. It was largely back then attacked as vicious, but is it factual?
Well, it's factual, but that's not the point. I mean, he was given a temporary release under the rules and the laws of what was of the state of Massachusetts.
Laws that Michael Dukakis signed into law.
Well, and the legislature had passed, the legislature is Republicans as well as Democrats, although the Democrats were in control. But that's not the point. The point is nothing was done to let him out on unusual beneficial circumstances. He got out because it was okay under the rules of that day for let him out, and when he was out, he committed a murder.
Congressman Al.
And plus, a lot of people, and this is hard to prove, but a lot of people felt that because Willie Horton was black and the ad in the view of many seemed to really press that point very subtly, but that it bordered on stirring up racist kinds of attitudes. If that was true, then I would say that was a scurrilous ad.
Well, there are those that claim it was a scare tactic, that none of the policies that Michael Dukakis signed into law, this is one that just...
See, I agree with that.
Yeah, well, the problem here was, going to the point Al made, we have enough problems in this country with the racial issue. And, criminals and all the rest of it, and so many of them are young black men because they don't have any jobs, no education, and they get in trouble. If that had been a white person, would you have felt differently that if Willie Horton had been a white person?
Well, again, let's be clear. Willie Horton, a black convicted felon in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, murdered a suburban white housewife outside of Boston. That was largely seen as a scare tactic and was largely seen as unconventional back in 1988.
It was pretty unconventional. But if Willie Horton had been a white person with the same criminal background, would it have been seen as different?
That's a good question.
It would have provided the precise criticism that they were leveling. It would have carried out their point. By stressing the fact he was black, you were adding...
But did the Bush campaign stress the fact he was black? At no time did they say,
no,
Willie Horton, a black convict from Massachusetts.
No, but they showed a picture.
They showed a picture. They have that very dark, sort of frightening imagery.
It was his Department of Corrections official photo.
It wasn't an accident.
Those aren't exactly glamour shots.
It wasn't an accident that they used those photos and probably darkened them a little bit. This ain't beanbag, folks, and that's not to defend these kinds of ads. My recollection is the ad ran once, then it became national news, so it
went viral.
Campaigns all over the viral at the time.
You didn't have to.
Simply, it was on TV all the time.
You didn't have to pay for the ad very much because you paid for it once and it went viral.
Right.
And same with Lyndon Johnson and the little girl at the atomic bomb.
Yeah.
Right. Right. But I guess the question that I want to get down to the point, and this is something that I know we'll talk about in the future, is what do we have to do, or can we even turn this around? Bob Hines.
I don't believe that you can turn campaign advertising around in the sense that negative ads will be for both. I think Brown and Warren up in Massachusetts, both of whom I respect as legitimately good people who made a strong effort to keep everything on the positive rather than the negative. And at this stage, Ms. Warren has gone negative, and Senator Brown has gone negative a little bit too. And the fact of the matter is, it's because the race is so tight, so close, and their campaigns are telling them, you have got to do this if you want to win.
Congressman Al first.
I think asking a campaign to be civil is like asking football to be safe. It's just the nature of the beast. Whereas where I think we should be concentrating is we really need to restore civility to the Congress. Where the policies are being made. That, I think, can be done with difficulty, but with leadership that moves.
But now, does one begat the other?
No.
It does not.
The very nature of legislation is that you're dealing with other legislators. It's a smaller group. You can talk to them, and if they're wrong, you can point out where they're wrong, and everybody in the body knows they were wrong, and all of that helps make it more civil. In a campaign, there's just no way of getting your arms around it, in my judgment.
Alan Moore.
Yeah, I agree. The campaigns are local, and however ugly they are, they get sorted out, and then you have an elected official. It is very rare that the ugliness of a federal election in a state will spill over, although I do remember an example. And it occurred in 2002 when a sitting senator from Georgia, Max Cleland, a triple amputee who had been in an accident in Vietnam. It wasn't a combat accident, but it didn't matter. He lost three limbs. He was a senator. And he was accused in the campaign of being soft on defense, and his opponent won, and the anger inside the Senate among Democrats, who happened to lose control of the Senate in that election of 2002, was palpable, and it took them months and months to be willing to work across the aisle. They eventually came around because the needs of the country do ultimately matter. But it was one of the rare cases, I think, where there was a state contest, the ugliness of which
overflowed into
lingered on. It had a half life that spilled over into the next session of Congress and lasted some months for the body and many years.
We see that today. We see that today with the birther issue. I mean, that has overflowed into federal politics. We've seen them discuss the question even on the floor. We had a congressman from Florida, Bill Posey, come up with a law that he presented in the hopper requiring Barack Obama to produce a legitimate birth certificate. Does that not cross over?
Well, that's one crazy guy. You know, that's not... That's
still a seated congressman.
No, I'm not saying... You don't have to be sane.
He's not crazy. Well, of course he's still a congressman. He's crazy.
My point is, it wasn't a movement that had a huge group of people behind it. It's just a handful of fringe folks.
Bob Hines, give you the last word.
I'll give you the last word. In 1884, Grover Cleveland was running for a second term. He lost.
You were an intern on that campaign, right?
That's right. I was an intern on that campaign. Against him, Rutherford B. Hayes, the Republican candidate, had a slogan, Mom, where's my paw? Going to the White House, ha, ha, ha. Illegitimate child.
Wow, good one,
That's why he lost the race. That's the first dirty campaign.
Wow, good one. Wow, way to go for the history lesson. When we come back, we're going to go to my favorite segment of the show. It's Tell Me a Story. We'll be back here in Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., in 3 minutes. This is Blog Talk Radio's Backroom Politics. Stay with us.
You know, you hear us talk about Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. It's being the place to be. America's premier cigar tavern, place to make new friends or visit old friends, or even have a lively political discussion like we do here on Backroom Politics. But what you may not know, Shelley's is the place for private parties. Shelley's Back Room is available to host events for groups of 10 to 250. From cocktail receptions to sit-down dinners, Shelley's can provide custom menu options to suit your needs and budget. Although Shelley's is a smoke-friendly environment, Shelley's can make accommodations for non-smokers based on the side of your party, but heck, why would you want to? With a cigar menu like they have here, why would you even consider going smoke-free? Event pricing varies based on the time of the day of the week chosen for your event. For more information on private parties at Shelley's Back Room, go to www.shelleysbackroom.com/private-party. Shelley's Back Room, the place to be, as Bob likes to say it. It's also the place for private parties.
Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics on Blog Talk Radio. Now it's time for my favorite part of the show, Tell Me a Story, where we talk about news, rumor, buzz going around. We try and scoop the major media markets. Sometimes we do, but this is a chance for us to show our insiderness. Alan Moore, I'm going to start with you. Tell me a story.
All right. Well, I was tempted to
to talk about the fact that Ralph Nader has accused President Obama of being a war criminal.
Yes.
Because of his weekly meetings to target people with drones. I mean, an issue we've talked about here on which the American people are remarkably silent. But I'm not going to talk about that because my favorite United States senator to annoy me on the annoyance scale, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, who I spent some time talking about his McCarthy tactics many weeks ago,
right.
when he talked about his secret source, who said that Mitt Romney had not paid taxes for some of the previous 10 years, and with no basis whatsoever. He's come back, and
what has he done now?
Last Friday, he said that Mitt Romney. Now they're both Mormons,
right?
And he said that agreed when asked that Mitt Romney had sullied was the word, the Mormon faith by his comments about the 47% that were secretly taken. So here is this guy who is the senior Democrat in the United States Senate, a man that I've known a little bit and I had a lot of respect for. It's a very tough job. He has gone off the deep end in my mind, enough so that my prediction is if the Democrats prevail and maintain a majority in the Senate, he will serve two more years as majority leader, and then they'll move him out. If they lose and become a minority, I think that there's enough disgruntled Democrats behind the scenes about his failings in public. They like him in private, but he's increasingly failing the Democratic Party in public, and I think he will be a goner as a minority leader, and then you'll see a battle royal between Dick Durbin and Charles Schumer from New York to see who prevails. But I think his days are numbered either way.
Good story. Bob Hines, tell me a story.
Ohio may be the most important state of all. Both candidates have been there in the last couple of days, all over the place. It's interesting, and it's to be expected because they've got
18
electoral votes, and Lord knows if you know. We all understand that Romney has to basically run the table to win the election, and Ohio stands out as a state that he is. Right now, there are several polls out that have come out in the last couple of days. Both of them say the same thing, that the president is leading 51 or 52 to 44 or 45. He is, so Romney has a major, major effort to catch up in Ohio. And I think that that's going to be the state that's going to decide the whole thing. And because I think we will probably know fairly early in the night, because Ohio reports relatively early.
Relatively early. They close at 7.
I think we ought to know by 8. We may know by 8 o'clock. You know, the projections will be, you know,
start coming in from there.
Start coming in, because it looks to me like Ohio is going to do something that they haven't done for a while. They're going to go for Obama for the second time.
Interesting. Ralph Woody, tell me a story.
Okay, after the election, look for a fight in the lame duck session between the Democrats and Republicans over the politics of milk. The farm bill is going to play a major issue after the presidential election, because there's going to be a spike in milk prices.
Interesting. Okay. Congressman, now I'm going to ask you, do you have a story to tell me?
I have a parochial story.
Can you do it in under 2 minutes?
Yes. It would take me longer to explain why I've arrived at this conclusion, but it's easy to say. The all the betting early on was that the Republican Attorney General, who has been running for governor of Washington State forever and doing a good job, and he's known to be bright and capable, was leading, and the Democrat, former Representative Representative Jay Inslee was looking poorly. Since the primary out there, which is now a Louisiana form of primary,
right.
Jay Inslee came out way ahead and is holding a lead currently in the polls. And I once bet against Jay Inslee winning an election. I will never do it again.
Wow.
I think he.
You think he'll take the attorney general's spot in Washington?
No, I think he'll take
a governor's mention in Washington.
I think it may be Governor Inslee.
Wow. Last week, I reported that the NFL strike was going to get very political. That several folks from the Vegas betting community, as well as certain key factions inside the NFL, were about to go to Congress and get political about the NFL referee strike. Fast forward to last night, the disaster that happened in Seattle, the Seattle Seahawks winning questionably against the Green Bay Packers. Since that, in the less than 24 hours since that fiasco, many people, including Governor Scott Walker and even former President Bill Clinton, are now talking about getting Congress involved in forcing the hand of both the Referees Association and Roger Goodell to come up with a solution quickly.
But they have gone home. Congress.
Congress has gone home. Correct. As of today, they're no longer in place. But be aware, there will be political pressure on both Goodell and the refs to come to a conclusion. They're now talking it is not just a money issue, because Governor Scott Walker says this could cost the state of Wisconsin $1 billion in ripple effect. It could also be a safety issue, which more and more people are starting to see. That story is going to keep coming back to us. On behalf of Congressman Al Swift, Alan Moore, Bob Hines, Ralph Winnie, I'm your moderator, Justin Russell. We'll be back next week here on Blog Talk Radio for Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Bob?
The place to be.
We'll see you next Tuesday, folks. Thanks for joining us. Bye-bye.
Boom.